When my dad died, it took my family more than a year to go through his closets and drawers, to sift through decades of life and love, for memories to cherish and clothes to give away to people less fortunate than we. It was the little things we each saved, the cufflinks, the books, a lock of hair, a silk tie that kept Dad close to us even after his passing. The little things that tie our frenetic lives to his, the best memories to savor and to pass on to our own children. Saving an object that belonged to someone close to us seems to come naturally to most of us. In fact, it is very likely that the first Christians kept the very first relics to, in some way, keep alive the memory of Christ and his saints. Since the very beginning, Christians have venerated relics of all shape and form, pieces of wood from the true cross, the body of a past pope, the finger of the doubting St. Thomas, the blood-stained bandage of Padre Pio, or the skull of St. Catherine, just to name a few. Relics obviously don't possess magic powers, but the Church does see them as a way the faithful can come closer to a person who was deemed holy, and they can help us form a closer bond with God. But why do relics fascinate Catholics and non-Catholics alike? Or is the veneration of relics simply a macabre superstition? Well, my colleague Susie Hodges spoke to Elizabeth Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology, about what constitutes a relic and how the Church has viewed them over the centuries.
A relic is an object which can be a part of a body or clothing or something that belonged to a saint, which is someone that the Church recognizes as being in heaven. Therefore, while their souls are in heaven, this object remains on earth as something that we can remember our tie between the earthly matter and the saint's soul in heaven.
Do we have any idea when the practice of venerating relics first began?
Well, the practice of venerating relics is an extremely, extremely old practice. It goes all the way back. We have a very well-documented case of St. Polycarp, whose body ashes were gathered together, and they were, as the people of Smyrna said, they were treasured more than precious stones. So the idea of the body of a martyr being something to preserve, to venerate, to take care of, is a very old tradition indeed, 2nd century AD.
But it's not just bodies, is it? I mean, for instance, Christ's cross was very quickly became an object of veneration and, according to legend, was broken up, wasn't it?
Yes, it doesn't have to merely be the body of a martyr. It can be an object that belonged to a martyr, but particularly the relics of Christ's passion have been extremely precious. The cross of Christ, of the crucifixion, was found by St. Helen in the early 4th century AD. By 354 AD, we know that the cross had already been broken up and sent across the empire because everybody wanted to have a piece, a part of this memory of Christ's salvific sacrifice.
Coming back, though, to the saints, it's true that at first the Christians, they venerated the saints, but they never actually dismembered the bodies. And yet afterwards, they did start to do that. Why? Do we know?
Actually, it's a funny little break between the East and the West on this one. We have an understanding in the 6th century AD in the western part of the empire, in Rome, a request for part of the body of St. Peter, which Gregory the Great answers by saying that we do not follow the custom of breaking up the bodies. In Rome, the custom was to lie a piece of cloth on the grave of a martyr, which would then be given or cut up or given to the faithful. Instead, in the East, the custom of breaking up the bodies, the custom of the body parts, is very, very old and very well rooted.
And at some point then they decided to follow the Eastern example.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the intermixing between the East and the West, particularly during the iconoclasm controversy, when the Eastern Church began to mix more with the Western Church. There was a series of Greek popes. I mean, there's a lot of intermixing which changed the custom. Also, similar to the fragment of the True Cross, it became also a question of ensuring that many different churches could have the relic of an apostle or someone extremely venerated throughout the universal church.
I know it must be difficult to pinpoint this, but can you think of some of the most famous or fascinating relics that we've had throughout history, or even that survive to the present day?
Well, some of them, the interesting relics divide up into two categories. There is a category of relics that are very moving and still to this day very powerful. The thorn from the crown of thorns, the relic of the true cross, as I want to say in the Church of the Holy Cross, it's the finger of St. Thomas that always catches my eye. The remains of certain saints, they're beautiful reliquaries with the heads of the four sainted Leos. So you have all four of the great Pope Leos in one reliquary. But then there's another class of relic, which are the completely specious, a little bit over the edge, crazy relics, which really come from an era of what could best be described as relic mongering, when everybody was so hungry for relics that they came up with all sorts of insane objects. Some of the darkness from the plague of Egypt apparently is bottled and kept in the Church of St. Mark here. Or you could have some of the breast milk of the Virgin. I mean, there were quite a few relics that
very inventive
are
people.
Very, very, very inventive. But that's when you know the relic situation has got out of hand.
But that was, as you say, back in the Middle Ages. Did it then afterwards sort of calm down a bit as perhaps people became a bit more better educated?
The Rome? Church has had to, if you will, crack down on several occasions, and going all the way back to St. Augustine. St. Augustine already warns about false relic mongers, people who dress up as monks and sell false relics. There are problems. There's another letter of a group of Easterners who came and dug up a bunch of bodies with the intention of bringing them back to the East, and here we're talking about the 6th century AD. So there's been a continuous ebb and flow of relic sales, relic fraud, and the church would crack down on them, particularly in the Councils of Trent, when the situation really was brought under control in the reforming councils. The Councils of Trent simply forbade any sale of relics, so there was no lucre attached to it.
But what's the church's official position on relics in the present day?
Well, the church's, it's the same position as it was at the time of the Councils of Trent. The relics are there to be venerated. We are not to attach any kind of magical powers to them, because it's not the relic itself that contains some kind of magic. It is God's ability to do grace, to give grace through the object of someone who is very dear to him, a saint. And therefore, the church suggests or allows us to venerate relics, allows us to see relics as a kind of portal to God's grace, but to not ever attribute it to the matter, but to the supernatural, to the divine behind it.
Now, when it comes to Rome, of course, as the home of the Catholic Church, there must be a lot of famous relics scattered about the city. Can you tell us about some of them?
Rome has an astonishing quantity of relics, and the first collection of relics, the greatest collection of relics, was in the Palace of St. John Lateran. There was the Sancta Sanctorum, which is known at the top of the Holy Stairs today, and it was a private chapel where only the Pope went, which had the most remarkable catalog of the saints, relics of the saints, various objects. The catalog was so precious, it was actually written in mosaic. It still exists, and the catalog is written in mosaic form. At the same time, the relics that are most precious to Rome are the bodies of St. Peter and St. Paul, which for centuries, millennia now, people have come to venerate and remember St. Peter and St. Paul, who both died on the soil, and thanks to them, the Church of Rome was founded. There's another great collection of relics, which is in the Pantheon. One of those things that people don't know so much about, because the Pantheon is always, it's a pagan building. It was constructed as a pagan building. It was turned into a church in 609, but it became St. Mary of the Martyrs, because when the catacombs were emptied in the 7th and 8th century, the bodies were brought to the Pantheon. And on certain feast days, an incredible array of reliquaries can be brought out into the altar of the Pantheon. And so you see in this
what
amazing
feast
building. Well, it's particularly Pentecost. The Pentecost is the greatest feast day for the Pantheon. It's the day that they drop the red rose petals in through the oculus. That's the greatest day of the year. But on other feast days, or even on a special mass, they'll bring out some of the reliquaries. But to see the altar, altar arrayed at Pentecost is remarkable.
Many modern Christians, particularly from Western countries, you know, do tend now to consider them a rather macabre superstition relics. I mean, do you think the number of those who are rather skeptical about them is growing?
Well, I think in our day and age, we have become far more skeptical. Although I would like to say that plenty of people were skeptical in the Middle Ages, plenty of people were skeptical in the Renaissance. Skepticism is not something that the 21st century has a monopoly on. But we seem to have closed ourselves off to that particular form of supernatural. And it has a lot to do with ignorance, with not understanding exactly what the function of a relic is, and a lot to do with just not much information about them. Very few people really understand what a relic is, what it means to have the body of a pope under the altar at St. Peter's. And surprisingly enough, the catechism itself doesn't give a lot of orientation. It actually barely mentions relics at all. So it is a kind of, people have become distanced from what is an age-old custom in the church of venerating, remembering, wanting to be close to people who lived on this earth just like them, but have succeeded in making it to heaven.
Nonetheless, despite, as you say, there may be these growing skeptics, there are an awful lot of other people who are still fascinated by them. There was a recent exhibition, wasn't there, of a bloody segment of bandage belonging to Padre Pio. So how do you explain this continuing fascination, at least on the part of some of the faithful?
The remnant of the bandage of Padre Pio coming to Rome was a big wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people. They planned a little procession, maybe, you know, a few people from the parish would come. The place was packed. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people came to see the relic of Padre Pio. When the body of St. Augustine was brought from Pavia down to Rome to be near his mother, hundreds of people came. And so it tells us that, you know, we are, it seems to indicate, let's say, that we are looking for that evidence of the supernatural. We're looking for, we still want it. It's that we're sort of shamed into having to take a more sophisticated, cosmopolitan, cynical, or skeptical approach, when indeed I think all of us in one way or another hunger to know that there's something greater out there, that there is some sort of contact, there's some recognition of the divine beyond our mundane daily lives.
Thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, a professor of Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus. She was speaking there to my colleague, Susie Hodges. And I'm Tracy McClure.